Will this be China's century? China is much in the news these days, from trade disputes with the United States to its treatment of minority populations and dissidents, to its influence over North Korea and the region and the world. I'm Keith Shortall. Today marks the beginning of the 32nd annual Camden Conference, and the focus this year asks the question, is this China's century? I'll ask that same question of my guests today as we explore some of the cultural, historical, and political factors that have helped to shape China's remarkable economic growth. And we want to hear from you. What do you think about the U.S.-China trade talks? Should the president maintain a tough position toward China? And what impacts are tariffs having on America and on Maine? What we may not understand about this rising global power. China, today on Maine Calling. First, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Keith Shortall, and this is Maine Calling. With the world's largest population and second biggest economy, it isn't surprising that China is much in the news these days. Right now in Washington, negotiators from the U.S. and China are trying to work out trade differences between the two countries. Today marks the beginning of the 32nd annual Camden Conference, and the theme this year is this China's century? I have with me today in our studio two of the speakers from the conference. Yuan Ang is with as Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Michigan. Robert Daly is Director of the Kissinger Institute on China and the United States at the Woodrow Wilson Center in Washington. And on the line with us from Camden is this year's keynote speaker, Martin Jakes, Senior Fellow at Cambridge University and the author of When China Rules the World, The End of the Western World and the Birth of a New Global Order. As always, we want to hear from you. Do you see China as a threat? How should the U.S. approach relations with China? Our phone number is 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Welcome, all of you, to Maine Calling. I'm going to start with Martin Jakes and with what's in the news this afternoon. So President Donald Trump scheduled to meet today with the special envoy to President Xi Jinping on trade. Martin Jakes, what's your sense of how this is going?
Oh, you start with an easy question. I don't think any of us really know. There has been a little bit of encouragement in that they seem to be, both sides seem to be making slightly positive noises, that something might be possible. And Trump has said that maybe the deadline of the beginning of March could be postponed a little if need be. But more than that, I can't really say.
Robert?
Well, I think that one of the questions is what should we wish for as an outcome? And I think that what we should wish for depends a lot on where you think the relationship is going. If you agree with the Trump administration that this is now a long-term contentious relationship with very high stakes to see which of these two very powerful nations will play a greater role, not necessarily a determinative role, but a greater role in shaping security architectures, trading regimes, the regulation of technology, norms and practices, value systems. If you see this as a long-term competition, then you don't necessarily want a resolution. You may want a doubling down and the imposition of more tariffs. So there's a great deal of concern that President Trump will settle for vague promises and the purchase of a few more soybeans and some liquefied natural gas. If, on the other hand, your major concern is sort of short-term and you believe that the United States and China can find a way to accommodate and work out a coevolution, then I think you want to see them settle for something that will tamp down tensions in the short term. And so that's really the big dividing line, I think.
Yuan Ang, what are you looking at when you are looking at these trade negotiations? Is it really the nuts and bolts of what they decide, or is it a bigger view for you and how these relations are going?
I expect that the both sides would likely come to a short-term compromise because both China and the U.S. need to catch their breath. Mm. The trade talks is damaging for both sides, and so I think it is in their interest to come up with a short-term compromise. But I would agree with Robert that even with a short-term compromise, this is more of a band-aid solution, and it does not address the long-term issue, which is that the two countries are now in a long-term contentious relationship, and how are they going to coexist with each other?
Yeah. Martin Jakes, to what extent does this whole trade standoff, if at all, reflect some of the things that you think the U.S. or the West in general just doesn't get when it comes to China?
Well, I think that the West has underestimated for a long time the rise of China and its durability and its potential. And I think the reason for that has been essentially that the West has viewed China beyond a point as non-sustainable in its present form because it was so different from us. You know, its political system is very different, and most notably, but in many different ways, China is very different from the West. And so I think that two things have really been seriously flawed in the American discourse about China. The first is that the lack of recognition on the part of the United States of its own decline. I mean, this has been really the unmentionable. I remember, I think it was in the State of Union address of Barack Obama in 2012, something like that. You know, he said, well, this talk of American decline is, you know, of course we're not declining. You know, it's nonsense to think in those terms. When of course, that's exactly what has been happening. So one problem is for America to address it. Now, I think that, perhaps ironically, you know, Trump has, in his own inimitable way, raised the question in a way that previously it had not been raised. The second question is about the potential of China. And this requires a huge paradigm shift in Western thinking about the nature of the world and the possibilities of a range of different countries. Essentially, the Western view has been that there is only one form of modernity, and that's the Western form. And that China, to succeed, had to be and was required to be like us. Now, it's now demonstrably clear that this is not true, that there will be many forms of modernity in the world, and that China is one, very important one, that China is very different from the West, always has been, always will be. And therefore, the American attitude, the Western attitude in general, it's true in my own country, in Britain as well, has to shift to a more pluralistic recognition. That there are, you know, there are different civilizations, there are different ways of doing things, there are different kinds of arrangements, and I think this is the great question, really, at the heart of the relationship between the United States and China, is for the Americans to come to terms with what China is and what where it's come from, and what it's going to be like. That's very, very difficult. Extremely difficult for the United States to do for very understandable reasons, but I think it's absolutely essential.
Just to follow up there, if you could talk a little bit about the China, as you see it, as not a nation state, as perhaps we would like to see it or expect that or have expected it to become, but rather being a civilization state, and just describe that, explain that.
Yeah, I mean, China has only called itself loosely as a nation state since the end of the 19th century. Of course, China is much older than that. Certainly, as in terms of a polity, it's over 2,000 years old. In other words, it's really the period in which it's been a nation state is a sliver of its history. And so China, China's mentality, China's political system, China's way of thinking, China's family relationships, attitudes towards the state, language, and so on, have been shaped over a long period by what I'll call civilizational influences. So China, and this is very different from, say, the European experience of nation states over the last several hundred years, or the United States, Australia, and so on. And so I think we can't understand China in conventional nation state terms. I don't think this is just about China, by the way, this question. But anyway, China has to be considered as, in that sense, as having two elements. One is a civilization state element, which I think is the more important in the long run, and the second is as a nation state. So in lots of ways, it's, I'll give you one example just to try and make this more concrete, and that is this is a huge civilization state, which we often think of as being highly centralized, but in fact, in many ways, because it's so big and because it's so diverse, it has many, many differences existing within it. And although China is a unitary system, essentially it works on a very decentralized basis in lots of respects. And provincial governments, for example, especially the big ones, are hugely powerful, much bigger than the vast majority of, much more powerful than the vast majority of nation states. So China has always, in a way, you know, it's been one civilization, many systems. I mean, now that shouldn't be taken too far, but certainly there's a strong element of that in the way that China works. So when, for example, it came to the handover of Hong Kong in 1997, at the behest of Deng Xiaoping, the proposal was, it should be based on one country, two systems. In other words, Hong Kong would be part of China, but would have a different system to that of the PRC. And essentially, although there's been obviously argument and debate about it, that continues to be the case. Most unusual solution to a problem. I mean, it would never be considered by a nation state. One nation, one system. Whereas civilizational thinking is one civilization.
And nobody believed that that would, that the two systems would be maintained. They assumed it would be absorbed by the Chinese system.
Well, it was for 50 years.
Yeah.
And we've now had 22 years.
Yeah.
And there's still, you're right, there are arguments about how it's been interpreted and so on. But basically, I think it's fair to say that the Chinese have been essentially observant of that agreement. After 50 years, no, it'll be different. But, you know, Hong Kong has lived under British colonialism for over 150 years. So even after 50 years, you know, the effects of all those differences and so on, I think will still be strongly felt within Hong Kong.
Let's talk a little bit about what we call the China model. Yuan Ang, there's lots of debate and anxiety around the China model. The debate is about what the China model is, and the anxiety for some in the West is this idea that developing nations might look to China and this model and its blend of market savvy and autocracy instead of Western democracy as a model to build their own futures. First, to the China model, though, what is it in your view?
The China model, in my view, is what I call directed improvisation, which is that even though the Chinese Communist Party under the reformist leader Deng Xiaoping rejected Western-style democracy, he liberated the bureaucracy and he changed the role of Beijing from that of a commander and a dictator to a director, to setting up the conditions for adaptation and innovation within the vast bureaucracy. And then you see this bottom-up, decentralized, massive wave of innovation within China starting from the 1980s. So this understanding of adaptive governance that really makes China work is very different from what many people come to understand today. A very simplistic understanding of the China model as merely top-down central planning, infrastructure investments. And the point that I like to make is that if you think about it, under Mao, you had top-down planning and you had infrastructure investments, but you didn't see the same results. So it couldn't be that those elements are the factors that make China dramatically successful after 1989. 80. Something must have changed. But those changes did not take political forms that we in the West expect to see, things like elections or constitutional protection of individual rights.
Yeah. A little bit later, when we have some time, I want to get into the different kinds of directives that come down from Beijing, mm-hmm. which sort of illustrates the flexibility that's built within the system.
Yeah.
But Robert Daley, we like to go, Americans like to sometimes go back and look at history to help us, to help inform us as to what's happening now. In with the question of the U.S. position versus other global powers, it's really hard to do that with the emerging China, right? We can't look to Japan or Soviet Union experiences and glean anything from that as to seeing what's coming.
I think we can glean very little from it. I don't think there's an appropriate historical analogy. Some people reach increasingly for a sort of Cold War 2.0. I don't think that sheds a great deal of light on the challenge from China, which really is unprecedented and is epochal. We haven't seen anything like this. There has been a lot of talk of Europe pre-World War I as a possible model, with the implication being that we might be headed for conflict with China. Others dismiss American concerns about China, pointing out that we were concerned about Japan in the 1980s, and then Japan stagnated. I don't think that any of these are particularly helpful. I think what we really do need are new models and new thinking, because this is a new challenge. America has essentially a peer competitor and will have for a very long time. And again, this global comprehensive competition. So no, we can pick little bits from some historical analogies. But what we really need is a clear-eyed view of, first, of ourselves. What is the United States? What is the American experiment for? Is the kind of preeminence we enjoyed following the Cold War really essential to American well-being and to the global system? Or can there be other models? It's a time for new thinking, which neither the United States nor China seems to be capable of at the moment.
And what is it about China that makes it so different from these you know, from Japan or from the Soviet Union that we feared on various levels?
Well, we've got an enormous scale. It's people times wealth. And in a very ambitious nation that not only is it a civilization state, as Martin Jakes has said, it's also extremely self-regarding and ambitious, and believes that a China-centric Eastern Hemisphere and possibly eventually a China-centric world is a natural, inevitable, desirable development. I think this is the view in Beijing. And when the notion that this is natural means that China is not to be blamed for seeking power. The notion that it's inevitable, of course, means resistance is futile. And the notion that it's desirable, it is to Beijing and I think to many within China, self-evident that China will be a benevolent great power. This is not at all self-evident to China's neighbors, however.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, your questions and comments. The number to join the program is 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do the Maine Health Cancer Care Network. World-class cancer care right here in the place that gives strength, home. And Andrucki & King, featuring Judy Andrucki, providing private mediation services in matters of family law. AndruckiLaw.com.
People in the U.S. have a history of dismissing racist, homophobic, or sexual violence. Recently, there have been calls to believe people who say they are victims. It appears Empire actor Jussie Smollett may have been taking advantage of that impulse.
It's not necessarily that you don't believe that this is the truth. You don't even want to see the truth.
This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered is today at 4 here on Maine Public Radio. Have you subscribed to The 10 yet? The 10 is Maine Public's free weekly emailed newsletter, our curated look at 10 exceptional, thought-provoking, and compelling stories, not necessarily from the front page, that you may have missed during the week, chosen from Maine Public, NPR, PBS, American Public Media, PRX, the BBC, and more. To sign up or to read past issues, go to mainepublic.org and click on the news dropdown. Enjoy.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Today on the program, will this be China's century? Joining me, Robert Daly. He's director of the Kissinger Institute on China and the United States at the Woodrow Wilson Center in Washington. Yuen Yuen Ang is an associate professor of political science at the University of Michigan. And Martin Jakes is a senior fellow at Cambridge University and the keynote speaker at this year's Camden Conference. We invite you to join the conversation. The number is 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. Tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. Martin Jakes, I want to go back a little bit to what makes China so unique and perhaps is difficult for Westerners to get their heads around with respect to, this national sense of unity around the Han Chinese. And secondly, around their view of government, that unlike the West, which we tend to see government as invasive and something not to be trusted, but there's a different view in China, you would say.
Yeah, I think that to understand almost the glue, which is in a way the word I think that you might use in terms of what holds China together. I mean, you know, China is a most extraordinary country. It's got 18%, pushing a fifth of the world's population. It's existed as a polity for over 2,000 years. It started off life, essentially, I suppose, as an empire. And so amongst its people have been many different ethnicities, many different races. Now, we know what happened to empires. One way or another, they've all more or less disappeared. And China is still, you wouldn't describe it as an empire now. It's now, a civilization / nation state, which is still holding together. Now, the extraordinary thing about this, really, is if you think about it, a country of this vastness and this diversity is subject to incredible centrifugal forces. There have been times in Chinese history where, in some significant measure, the centrifugal forces have had the upper hand over the centripetal forces holding it together. But nonetheless, China survives and now prospers. And not only that, but if you look at Chinese history, then, it's not just had one great period, as it were, under the sun. China has had several great periods, really. You can argue which ones, but the Tang or the in some senses the Song and so on. And it looks as if China is now entering another such period. So this is the most extraordinary phenomenon, which in some senses is obviously unique in terms of the world. And I'd add to that, I mentioned that China was composed of many different races. Polls suggest that well over 90% of the Chinese regard themselves as Han. Now, how did that happen? How do you explain that? Because you've only got to go to China to see that the Han is very diverse. So China's relationship with race is an extremely interesting question as well. And it's that, I think, that one of the most remarkable features of China is that one way or another, over hundreds of thousands of years, this sense of affinity between what now people call themselves as Han feel for each other and their relationship with the country. Now, this is so different from India, for example, and in my view, given its size, anywhere else. So I think that's that. As we reflect on this historically and as well as contemporaneously, then this is very important. The other question that you raise concerning governance and so on, well, it's certainly very different. I think that we shouldn't ignore the continuities between the imperial period and the communist period, because I think they help us to understand why the communist period has been accepted and is relatively regarded by the Chinese as sort of legitimate and effective. Now, what are the things that that legitimize the state and the form of governance in China? I think, well, one could immediately say three or four points. Firstly, the state is regarded as the guardian, if you like, even the embodiment of China, in a way that I mean, it's completely opposite to the United States, for example, but is also very different from India or most other countries. That people in a sense see themselves in terms of the state, or see the state even as an expression of themselves. Now, this I regard this to be a characteristic in China's case of a civilization state. Secondly, I mean, there's the whole familial notion of leadership coming from Confucius and so on. You know, a good ruler is like a good, in patriarchal terms, as was, is like is like a good father in the family and so on. And this familial way of looking at things is very powerful in China. And the third thing for now I'd say is the importance of meritocracy. And here I think the Chinese system has some really strong advantages over the Western system, because of course there's corruption and it varies over time, but there's always been significant corruption in China. There's lots of problems. But the fact of the matter is that by and large, those who are responsible for governing China are extremely good and competent at it. Are more, I would say, horses for courses, more competent than the governance systems in the United States or Britain or France and so on. So I think those three things we can add to them. These three things characterize the way the success are reasons for, in this era, the success of China.
Let me run this by the two other panelists here and get their take on that. And this the role of the powers, these forces of the unity of the Chinese people and their view toward government. We'll start with Yuan Ang. What do you think about what Martin just said?
I think that we should qualify our understanding of meritocracy in China. It is true that China has some meritocratic qualities. For example, Chinese officials are all well-educated. They all have college degrees or even higher. And to that extent, you can say that it's meritocratic. But then you then look at the realities whereby, in addition to having a college degree, is it the case that the most competent and honest people are always put in positions of power and are the ones being promoted? And when you look at the reality, you find that, well, that's not always the case, because we know, for example, that China has a big corruption problem, which the party itself has been very honest about. And since she started the anti-corruption campaign, more than 1.5 million officials have been put under disciplinary action. And so on the one hand, it's meritocratic to the extent that education is prioritized, but that is actually just a very basic criteria for defining what merit is. And the reality in China is that the system of selection and promotion, because it is top-down, people are often selected on the basis of their connections and their patronage ties, their relationships with superiors. So it has some advantages, but I think we also need to be aware of the great limitations of this system that some call meritocracy.
Yeah, the primary criteria of meritocracy is survival based on not making enemies with people in power in China. If it was a pure meritocracy, how do we explain the fact that Xi Jinping himself is a princeling, is a second-generation leader who comes from a previous red leader? These were privileged from his very childhood. You know, he was raised in privileged enclaves. Yes, he was kicked around during the Cultural Revolution, as were so many of them, but these are mostly a princeling class, and there is a big problem in corruption that I think we need to state very strongly. Xi Jinping, on the one hand, says that only the Chinese Communist Party could possibly lead China onto greatness, continued greatness, and yet the biggest problem, the biggest challenge that China faces is the endemic corruption of the Chinese Communist Party. Well, how are we to explain this? Civilizational understanding of China is essential to our analysis of what's going on there. But in fact, for international relations unfolds day to day, week to week, month to month. So we have to bring in not only China's civilization, but the leadership now of the Chinese Communist Party, which is increasingly repressive at home under Xi Jinping and increasingly aggressive internationally, which is built using technology to build a surveillance state, which is threatens to become a form of sort of soft and in some cases hard totalitarianism, which is locking up Uyghurs, possibly over a million of them, in re-education camps. And so when we think about the U.S. and China in terms of our ability to shape global norms, the question we have to ask is, do we want to live in a world that is increasingly amenable to an increasingly repressive and aggressive Communist Party? That's got to be on the table.
Well, let's take a call on that. We'll go to Susan in Bath. Hi, Susan. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I am calling as a Tibetan follower of a Tibetan Buddhist teacher. And so in listening to all of this, what comes to mind, and I haven't heard too much discussion of, is the state of human rights abuses in China. Ai Weiwei, the artist who was held under house arrest, Liu Xiaobo, if you look at their creations, if you read the document that ultimately landed Liu Xiaobo in jail, it reads like a page from the main Democratic Party platform or even the Republican Party platform. So I'd be interested to hear panelists speak about what is the state of human rights abuses currently in China, and how do we not lose sight of this as we, you know, we too are, there are many American princelings who like China because it's allowed them to indulge American greed. So I'd be interested to hear panelists speak to that.
Okay. Thank you very much, Susan. Yuan, do you want to go first? Oh, Robert, you want to?
I think the human rights situation in China is somewhat paradoxical. It has gotten considerably worse under Xi Jinping by almost any metric. One of his key sayings is that the party must lead everything, control everything. And so universities, the media, think tanks, the creative classes, the civil societies have all been called on to serve socialism and serve the people in a Maoist way. And they're more Han dissidents, lawyers, as well as Tibetans and Uyghurs have all been locked up. So it has been a retrograde situation under Xi Jinping. Why is it paradoxical? Most Chinese don't experience this. Most Chinese to date have been more or less satisfied with continued improvements in their material well-being. And if you go to China, despite this building of a surveillance state, you'll see people in the big cities are not skulking in the streets. The energy comes up through the sidewalks. People are ambitious and innovative and forward-looking. And so by some measures, this is the best time in Chinese history to be a Chinese. But by any international standard, including the UN Convention on Human Rights, human rights situation in China is getting worse and worse. So we need to recognize both the tremendous progress in well-being in China as well as the recent retrograde movement.
Yeah. Yuan, did you want to...
Yeah, and I do agree with Robert. I think there's a general assessment that under Xi, the human rights situation has gotten considerably worse, and also researchers have had a lot less access to China, so we are unable to actually study and collect data and speak systematically about these issues. On the side of Beijing, I think they have been trying to redefine the concept of human rights as bringing about sort of a good, prosperous life for a large number of people, which I think speaks to Robert's point about, you know, the regular Chinese person not experiencing repression and actually feeling that there is a great deal of opportunities and aspiration in their lives. And I think there is perhaps some merit to that idea, but at the same time, it is very, very important for the Chinese to understand the importance of human rights, because this concept of individuals, that the individual right is sovereign, is still relatively foreign in the Chinese idea, where collectivism and the overall benefit is prized over what any particular individual feels. And so this is something of a conceptual, this is something of a concept that is quite alien to the Chinese understanding of what matters, where collective is prized over individual. And I think it is very important to introduce this idea to China, which I think there is an opportunity to the extent that Chinese society is actually becoming more and more individualistic.
Yeah. All right. We're going to take another quick break. When we come back, more of your questions and comments. The number 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Coffee by Design, a locally owned business committed to quality. Roasted-to-order coffees available online at coffeebydesign.com.
1 year out from the first primaries, we check in on a growing 2020 field.
People seem to be sort of not wanting to say who they love, but who they think others will love.
Plus, a conversation with Stacey Abrams.
I am going to continue fighting until we see a fair elections process in Georgia.
Next time on The Takeaways, Politics with Amy Walter from WNYC and PRI.
The Takeaway is tonight at 7 here on Maine Public Radio.
The only jail for women in Berkshire County, Massachusetts, is actually in the county next door.
How do you do anything complex when your client is, you know, 2 hours away?
On Next from the New England News Collaborative, we discuss the challenges facing incarcerated women and their families in Western Mass. And have you ever eaten razor clams, slipper limpets, or periwinkles? A new cookbook teaches you how. Please join us.
Coming up at 2 here on Maine Public Radio.
And welcome back. I'm Keith Shortall. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, will China dominate world affairs this century? Joining us, Yuan Ang. She's an associate professor of political science at the University of Michigan. Robert Daly is director of the Kissinger Institute on China and the United States at the Woodrow Wilson Center in Washington. And Martin Jakes is a senior fellow at Cambridge University. Join the conversation. Give us a call. Our number is 1-800-399-3566. I want to get to, how China is trying to influence covertly or overtly public opinion in this country. I did promise, Yuan, that we were going to get to this. I wanted to ask you about how directives from Beijing, there are different types of directives that come down from Beijing that do allow some flexibility for companies or other experiments that are going on. Can you talk a little bit about that briefly?
Yeah, I think the common stereotype of China is that it's a command economy, and so whatever directives that come from Beijing is a set of detailed commands about what local governments should do exactly. But the reality is not what we imagined. The reality is that the way political communication in China works is that you can broadly divide directives into three types. There are one type of directives that I call red lines, which are directions about there are certain things that you cannot do. For example, there is a quota for the amount of land that local governments can sell, and this is considered a red line, a rule that cannot be violated. There is also a second type of directive that I call the black policies, which are policies that very explicitly endorse a particular course of action, and these are the types of policies that basically get one particular local experiment scaled up nationwide. And the third one is the most interesting and the one that I think most people have never heard about, which is that most directives in China are in varying degrees of ambiguity. They're gray policies. There is a tremendous amount of vagueness in Chinese policies, and it is not a mistake. This vagueness actually provides room for local interpretation, flexibility, generating feedback for Beijing to then calibrate what its next step should be, whether it should scale up a local experiment or whether it should forbid it. So to give an example, Beijing is now considering a new foreign investment law, and this law is vague. And I think this vagueness allows them to deal with a lot of contingencies in the global environment that we now see.
Yeah. We lost Martin Jakes on our line, so I wanted to make sure he's back now. Martin, are you back with us? You wanted to weigh in on a previous point, so I'll give you that opportunity.
I just wanted to some extent support what Wen said about the problem of the way in which human rights was interpreted and seen in China. I mean, I'd make three very quick points. Firstly, I think that the general picture of human rights in China is hugely better over the compared with 40 years ago or 20 years ago. I always cringe a bit when I hear Westerners talking about human rights and then never saying anything about 700 million people being taken out of poverty, as if that isn't perhaps the most important human right of all. So this has been an tremendous achievement by China to do that. Secondly, I think that one of the biggest failures of the PRC since 1949 has been with regard to Xinjiang and Tibet, in that clearly there's been a deep problem of recognition of the cultural and religious rights of the Uyghur and the Tibetans, and there is a pattern, particularly in Xinjiang, of repression in relation to them, and this is in the context of a country which, in many ways, is extremely ethnically diverse. So I think that, recently, what do I think about Xi Jinping? I mean, I think Robert overstates the case, but I do think that there has been a reduction of certain kinds of rights, of information, of campaigning, of legal redress, and so on in China during this period. Stronger direction regard to various institutions like universities and the media. I think that is certainly a characteristic of this phase, but I don't think it can change the basic historical achievement of the last 40 years.
Yeah. Yuan, did you want to respond?
Yeah, I wanted to build off of Martin's point, which is that I think when Westerners talk about human rights in China, it is very helpful for the audience from the West to talk about human rights abuses in their own country. And not only that, to talk about how Western democratic societies admit the mistakes they've made and come to terms with it and make amends for it. You know, what was the process of reflection and penitence? And this is very important and, in a sense, educational for the Chinese side, because the common retort that I hear in China is that, oh, the West has no right to talk to us about human rights because the West has had human rights abuses. And what they often don't perceive is that, yes, the West had a lot of human rights abuses, but the benefit of a democratic society is that people get to freely talk about it and then problematize it and debate about it and come to terms with it. This is something that China needs to learn. China has a hard time admitting mistakes. And so this is often a point that I try to make when I go to China, which is that there's this concept of, you know, if on the public stage, you know, we admit that we've made a mistake, that makes us look bad. There's always this sort of cultural concept that, you know, we should not tell others about the mistakes we've made. And what China needs to understand is that it is okay to admit that you've made mistakes. And in fact, that's a very essential part of learning, and including in the realm of human rights.
We only have about 3 minutes left, so I want to give each of you a chance to respond to this question of if you were to prescribe direction to the United States in order to improve its relationship with China and optimize the mutual benefits of that country's growth and our own situation, what would that be? And I'll start with you, Robert.
We need to greatly strengthen our alliances to bring pressure from the more or less liberal countries on China. At the same time, we need to acknowledge that China is still changing. The story of modern China is a story of change. We ourselves need to be open to more change than we are open to at present. And we need to recognize that China is not the source of most American problems. America itself is. And the real need is to up our game in many regions.
It's just follow up. Up our game in what sense?
We need to strengthen our democracy, our own politics. We're highly divided. We have now allowed anger to become the major engine of American politics. We don't have a very strong sense of common cause. And we have some unsustainable economic ideas, including the idea that Americans can have things that they shouldn't pay for and that taxes are bad.
Martin Jakes, if you were the U.S. Secretary of State, what would you advise that we do in the decades going forward for a better relationship, a better understanding with China?
I think the great question is that the United States comes to terms with the future of China as its equal, if not even in some, probably in the longer run, more powerful, and finds a way of having a successful relationship with China on that basis. That is very, very difficult, because as I know from my own country, it's very difficult when you've been on top for a long time to recognize that you're no longer in quite the position that you were previously, and you have to accept that situation with generosity, modesty, and humility.
And that's not just toward China. This has sort of been because we've enjoyed being on top in many ways for so long, we really haven't had to learn about other cultures or understand them.
No, I think that unfortunately America's by and large very ignorant about the rest of the world. This is going to be very, very difficult for America. And it's not going to be something that's achieved in, you know, 4 years or a decade or 2 decades or 50 years. It's a very, very challenging long-term historical process. I mean, in my own country, Britain, you know, I'll be frank with you, and that is we've never, ever managed to reinvent ourselves in the aftermath of imperial decline, which is why we're having such terrible problems now over Brexit. The country is absolutely convulsed. And the convulsion is around the failure of our culture and our politics to come to terms with decline.
We have to cut you off. I want to give Yuen Ang the last word here before we go.
Yeah, thank you. I would say that American policymakers and the American public needs to develop an appetite for balanced analysis, an analysis that considers two sides of the issue. And over time, we have lost the appetite and the supply of balance analysis. What we now get is extreme analysis on either sides. Either China is evil or China is great. And we really need to have a supply and appetite for balance analysis in order to understand the situation.
All right. Yuen, Robert, Martin, thank you all for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yuen Ang is an associate professor of political science at the University of Michigan. Robert Daly is director of the Kissinger Institute on China and the United States at the Woodrow Wilson Center in Washington. And Martin Jakes is the keynote speaker at this year's Camden Conference. He's a senior fellow at Cambridge University and the author of When China Rules the World, The End of the Western World and the Birth of a New Global Order. And a special thank you to Bruce Cole, president of the Camden Conference, for his help in making today's show happen. Lucy Suchek ran the board today. You can find past editions of Maine Calling, as well as helpful links and resources, by visiting mainecalling.org. Today's show will be broadcast again tonight at 8. The Maine Calling theme was composed by Mike Jandro. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Keith Shortall. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.